Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, welcome to Nature Now. When spring continues in spite of gray skies and interminable rain, Robert Frost wrote, "Nature's first green is gold." And I'm seeing this as the deciduous leaves colored chartreuse emerge on our native maples. We will proceed, but you know, first of all, the mystery sound. And I want to add that that Frost quote, "Nature's first green is gold," has a clue for which bird makes that mystery sound. We are meeting again today with hydrologist Ann Soule, water resource manager for the city of Sequim. And this show, I hope, will bring us more understanding of how our beautiful region collects and uses water. Hi, Ann. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Mary. Great to be here again.
Obviously, the weather has been leaning on us and causing a lot of discomfort. Living here has been chilly and soggy. And when we talked, you suggested that our themes for this could be temperature, tools, and time. So let's start with temperature.
Sure. Yeah, I think that little alliteration works every time we talk. Clearly, people are tired of cold weather. We had a little reprieve yesterday afternoon, and here we are again today with drizzle and clouds and moisture and cold temperatures. And I think we have a right to complain, but if you have noticed, you know, how much heat and drought and lack of water so much of the world is suffering from right now, we shouldn't be complaining technically. But yeah, so let's talk about local temperatures. And what it means for us is that, yeah, we might be sad about it, but the mountains are happy. And all of us hydrologists are happy to have that snow retained in the mountains as our cool temperatures that we have down here. It's extra cold up there, meaning that the snow is sticking around and it's not disappearing yet.
Didn't we have some snow even in Sequim earlier this spring?
Oh, gosh, yes. We've had snow in Sequim. I live at about 1,500 feet. We've had snow at my house like twice in the month of May and several times in April. It's really funny that the snowpack up high was common at a common place, just like around 80% of normal back on April 1st, which is when they typically say you've got your maximum snowpack. Typically right around the 1st of April. Well, it's now more like 140% in the Olympics.
Good heavens. So at this point, a person might say, golly, how do we learn what's happening up there from on-site observations? How do we get them? And this is really an unusual place, I think, to be in the middle of May. So how do our observations help us?
Oh, they help us enormously. As far as that tools topic, I know we like to kind of reflect on how we get this data. And there are weather stations called SnowTel, which means telemetry with snow data. There's four of them in the Olympic Mountain Range, one of them in the Dungeness Watershed, and that's the one I pay most attention to. There's also one in the further east that would perhaps be a little more relevant for the Coal Seam Basin and Port Townsend, and then two others. They measure snowpack, temperature, air temperature, and then they also measure the weight of the snow, which gives them an estimate of the snow water equivalent. And that SWE unit, that term, gives forecasters a better idea of what's to be expected for runoff later, because, you know, snow melt is what drives our ecosystem, our rivers that receive that snowmelt during the late spring when it's melting, that's always been a reliable part of our hydrology and our entire ecosystem here.
That means the eventual water movement into rivers is what you're looking for in this whole area. Do we have a sense that some years the snow does melt out early, which we don't seem to be in the middle of that now, but when it does, that really cuts back summer supplies?
Exactly. Yep. The water we have in our rivers in summer is thanks to, largely thanks to melting snow that came in the winter. So when you see, like in about July, if you still see good snowpack up in the mountains, if you can still see snow in the peaks, that snow is melting and you know that it hasn't all disappeared yet. And I'm just hoping and assuming that that will be the case in 2022. I think we can hope for that. I wanted to mention that, you know, there's been some years when we haven't had anything, like the 2015 is the classic one. Last summer, even, we didn't have all the runoff still that we would have wanted in August and September. It was gone. Yeah, 2015 was the extreme, but it happens periodically, almost, I should say, regularly these days. So this is a real unusual situation. Now, interesting story I heard recently about British Columbia. They have a concern that if we had a heat bomb, if we had like that extreme heat that we had at the end of June last year that melted our snow fast, there is so much snow in the mountains that it would cause flooding, which is just, you know, that's the flash flood situation kind of thing that you might expect in the Southwest, but we just don't have that here. But they pointed out that with the volume of snow, if it were to melt fast, they'd have some flooded rivers and communities.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Here, we talk about snow feeding our rivers. Is snow the only source of water during the dry season? I mean, for instance, I was thinking of Seattle. They have the whole Cedar River system that has reservoirs. What's going on about that here?
Mm-hmm. Here, we do not have municipal supply reservoirs, except for relatively small ones that are used to maintain the pressure in our communities, in our water pipes. We don't have big water storage reservoirs like they do in the Cascades for most of the cities over there. However, there's irrigation supply reservoirs in the Dungeness watershed, swim area to feed the farming around here. And yeah, I don't think City of Port Angeles has a reservoir. I mean, obviously the Elwha River reservoirs that with the dams that were taken down, those dams were mostly for power uses, not water supply. The water supply for Port Angeles comes from the river flow itself, did not come from directly from the reservoir. So no, there's no municipal reservoirs. However, I have to say, I want to say Port Townsend, City of Port Townsend might have something. I can't speak to that very well.
What I was wondering about reservoirs, I think, yes, Port Townsend built one, partly because there's an industrial need with the paper mill, and that they were taking care of that, which essentially puts a lot of the observation and the behavior on the individual person who's hanging out, enjoying themselves in the summertime. I think we would like to know what's going to happen for the coming summer. It's encouraging and surprising to hear that the snowpack is at 140%. Is that what you said? Whoa. Is it possible to predict for summer, or how does that actually work?
It's a matter of quantifying the snowpack and looking at the long-term weather outlook. What I've heard, they're not expecting a hot, dry summer like we had last year. So my unofficial prediction is that we will not run out of water for the needs of salmon or irrigators or cities, you know, this year, in the kind of way that we've had in the last several times over the last 10 years. So we're looking relatively good. Again, I think when you look into the mountains in about 4th of July timeframe, you see some snow patches, you can be very thankful for that.
I think I remembered you said when we talked one time before that the farmers used to look at the snowpacks to see what they resembled and that they had an idea about what their summer would be like because they were used to looking at those snowpacks. They didn't have snowtell, but they had their individual response to what they had seen.
Exactly. Yeah. The former version of what we measure now with technology, they had their anecdotal and their experience to draw from. And if there were certain symbols and patterns in the snow patches up in the peaks, then they could say, well, we're going to be great through August, or no, we're not.
And did they generally have an irrigation system early on when agriculture started?
Well, yeah, when white settlers came to Squim, I think they were starting to farm, but it was such a dry area back in the late 1800s that it was in the 1890s that somebody said, hey, that river seems to swell every single summer with lots and lots of runoff. What if we harness some of that and divert it to our farms? And boy, that was someone's bright idea, and it caught on, and the irrigation system, the irrigation network spread to hundreds of miles of ditches just within a couple of few decades back then.
If there were a summer shortage, which we are hopefully and prayerfully thinking will not happen this year, does that irrigation water ever get diverted to municipal uses other than agriculture?
No, not to replace municipal uses, because, you know, municipalities have to have health measures to that everything that they provide to their customers and their city, whether it's industrial users or domestic or commercial or businesses, all of that has to meet the health standards. And so, no, you would not just replace irrigation ditch water for municipal water.
Okay, that is obviously sensible. And in addition, there's been some front page news about the disappearance of the Olympic glaciers. Alarming. And there must have been a reason why somebody decided that within 50 years, the Olympic glaciers will be gone. What's your take on that?
Yeah. Isn't that ironic when we have such a big snowpack this year and all of a sudden it just happens to be that the research is coming out how dire the situation is as far as the long-term health of our frozen water supplies. The Olympic glaciers have been shrinking fast in the past 100 years. And we have every year there's more data supporting that. And yes, maybe this year we'll actually have glaciers grow a little bit instead of getting smaller in size, you know, by the time we get to the next rainy season in October. But we can't know for sure. Over the long term, they're really shrinking, and we are going to be having a difficult time with our river water supplies in particular. Now, the rivers also feed the aquifers, the groundwater system, yeah, and people's wells. So it's all connected. And anything we can do to slow global warming and conserve water, or just kind of get used to not using as much when we don't absolutely have to, is gonna help.
At this point, just personally, global warming is very hard to accept, even though it's clearly there. This is happening, but the response of the average person, I would say that I'm the average person, is just to stand in the middle of the room shouting, no, that can't be. So I'm thinking that the future of this area will have to use ways of planning water, mm-hmm, new ways, right, perhaps.
Right. Our farms, commercial farms, or your family garden, or just using water inside the house, using, you know, the paper mills use a lot of water for their industry. Uh-huh. All of those needs will have to be thought about, and where are the supplies going to come from if you aren't able to get what you're used to getting? You know, for example, Quilcene River does not have a huge watershed, does not have a lot of glaciers in its upper reaches. So the users of the Quilcene River, especially the larger users, what if it's a dry year and they don't get the rain and the flow in the river just isn't as much? Mm. So, you know, whether or not your source is snowmelt or rain that contributes to the flow and also contributes to aquifers as well, because so much of that water infiltrates, everybody's got a plan for what to do in a dry year, whether it's a one-year drought or a 10-year drought.
So the future is definitely going to have to include water planning. And what do we already have for recommendations for maintaining our water supply? I live near a busy golf course, which everybody appreciates, and that's another place where water is needed. So what can the average citizen do besides looking at the mountains in July on the 4th, which I will certainly do, to see how the snowpack looks? Last summer, the mountains looked like a row of brown rocks, period. So what more can we recommend to each other about using water carefully? It's not an old, it's a story that's been told before, but I think it helps to hear it again.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, the biggest thing that an individual can do is to make sure that their outdoor use is really responsible and not letting any extra water not needed for your plants either be wasted by evaporating or used up by crops that maybe aren't suited to this area. Well, such as lawn. Keeping a green lawn in August or September, I think most people are aware that that's just not a wise use of our limited water, unless it's raining. You know, if the rain is doing it, awesome. But to put demand on the overall system for that particular use, that would be the main thing I would say for individuals. And, you know, of course, there's the indoor water conservation and being careful about your teeth brushing and your laundry loads and your dishwashing loads and long showers, short showers, that kind of thing.
Everybody in my family has always caught shower water in buckets.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yes. While the shower's warming up, catch it in the bucket. Catch it in the bucket. My mother was a gardener in California through many drought times, and she recycled water at a great rate.
So let me jump in. I didn't mention gray water, but what they call gray water is your shower and your kitchen sink drainage, because it's not contaminated necessarily and could be used for irrigation. And a lot of people do that. It's a matter of whether your local government will allow you to do that. And I believe it's also the state. I think the local governments have to then ask the state, you know, is that approved to utilize gray water for irrigation? Because sometimes it's not.
I wrote a column in the Seattle Times some years ago about gray water, and it was likely, I was taking it from my bathtub out to the garden by virtue of a kind of tricky hose, and the health department was not happy. The municipal department did not move in, but the health department felt that that was, at that point, they were saying that was not a safe use of water. And I think in the San Juans, that is very, very common. Or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think that many parts of the country and world do it perfectly safely. It's a matter of everybody knowing, you know, how to make sure that you're doing it safely and making sure the pipes have backflow prevention and you're not getting anything contaminated into an area that would affect people's health.
Right. And certainly there are builders who are now working out those systems in ways that we might all wish our houses had. So,
right. Yep.
And I'm really glad that you have been able to be with us, and especially with this crazy snowpack.
Yeah. It's a crazy time. I always like speaking with you when we've got news to report about the water and the snowpack.
Right. So you heard it here first, folks. Okay. Thank you very much, Anne.
You're welcome. I
am going to proceed to the mystery sound. This is the willow goldfinch, and I was inspired to say this because one of them flew through my yard this week, and really amazing bird. They're sometimes called the American goldfinch, but the one we have here is a subspecies called the willow goldfinch. And this brilliant bird became the Washington State bird decades ago, thanks to school children. In 1928, legislators let school children select the state bird, and the meadowlark won, hands down. Well, it was a nice choice, but seven other states had already chosen the same bird. So in 1931, they had another vote, and this time it was the Washington Federation of Women's Clubs. I gather most of those were garden clubs. Many birds were nominated. The goldfinch won handily over the tanager, the song sparrow, the junco, and of all things, the pileated woodpecker, which would be a great state bird. But the legislature decided to leave the final choice to school children. In 1951, children voted for the willow goldfinch. The state legislature agreed unanimously. That may be the last unanimous vote that ever happened, but they agreed unanimously. And this may cause some wonder, I think, as to how many of those voting school children had actually seen a willow goldfinch. The males are unforgettably bright in spring when they're in full breeding yellow. The one that flew through my garden just absolutely brightened up a dark day. But in late fall and winter, when not breeding, the male feathers change to a grayish yellow. You could almost call it a brownish yellow. And then the male matches the female's year-round color, which is, like many, many female birds, a little more drab. They are attractive, but not eye-catching. And the willow goldfinch nests in summer later than many birds. And one suggested reason for that is that they are almost exclusively seed eaters, and they need to nest when the fields have got plants that have gone to seed. They live in forests or on the edge of forests, and they also eat buds, maple sap — that would mean you'd have to be hanging out with a sapsucker — and the bark of young twigs. They are not considered endangered. They live year-round in Western Washington, and one source I read said they tend to flock. I think a flock of spring yellow male goldfinches would be a very memorable sight. So that's our state bird, the willow goldfinch. Thanks to Ann Soule for sharing her expertise, and to Nora Patrick, who always gets us our engineering the way it needs to be. This local and eclectic show runs several times during the week, and the joy of it all is you can listen again on podcasts, which are retained for months and months, and they will appear on KPTZ after the show airs. Our music for today is Frédéric Chopin's Raindrop Prelude. It is named, perhaps, for the insistent left-hand notes that carry the effect of rain falling. I listened to several versions of this, and this particular one, you can really hear drop, 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 drop. Strangely, the pianist on this one was anonymous. So that's it for Nature Now in mid-May. Thanks to all. Thank you.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.